Good Omens, The Nice and Accurate Prophecies of Agnes Nutter, Witch, by Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett. Continuing on page 258. Newt read it and blushed, and gave it back, tight-lipped. It wasn't simply the fact that Agnes had known, and had expressed herself in the most transparent of codes. It was that, down the ages, various devices had scrawled encouraging little comments in the margin. She passed him the damp towel. "Here," she said, "hurry up. I've got to make the sandwiches, and we've got to get ready." He looked at the towel. "What's this for?" "Your shower."
"Ah, so it was something men and women both did." He was pleased he'd got that sorted out.
"But you'll have to make it quick," she said.
"Why, have we got to get out of here in the next 10 minutes before the building explodes?"
"Oh, no, we've got a couple of hours. It's just that I've used up most of the hot water. You've got a lot of plaster in your hair."
The storm blew a dying gust around Jasmine Cottage, and holding the damp pink towel, no longer fluffy, in front of him, strategically, Newt edged off to take a cold shower. In Shadwell's dream, he is floating high above a village green. In the center of the green is a huge pile of kindling wood and dry branches. In the center of the pile is a wooden stake. Men and women and children stand around on the grass, eyes bright, cheeks pink, expectant, excited. A sudden commotion. 10 men walk across the green, leading a handsome, middle-aged woman. She must have been quite striking in her youth, and the word vivacious creeps into Shadwell's dreaming mind. In front of her walks Witchfinder Private Newton Pulsifer. No, it isn't Newt. The man is older and dressed in black leather. Shadwell recognizes approvingly the ancient uniform of a witchfinder major. The woman climbs onto the pyre, thrusts her hands behind her, and is tied to the stake. The pyre is lit. She speaks to the crowd, says something, but Shadwell is too high to hear what it is. The crowd gathers around her. A witch, thinks Shadwell. They're burning a witch. It gives him a warm feeling. That was the right and proper way of things. That's how things were meant to be. Only. She looks directly up at him now and says,
"That goes for yow as well, yow daft old fool."
Only she is going to die. She is going to burn to death. And, Shadwell realizes in his dream, it is a horrible way to die. The flames lick higher. And the woman looks up. She is staring straight at him, invisible though he is. And she is smiling. And then it all goes boom. A crash of thunder. That was thunder, thought Shadwell as he woke up, with the unshakable feeling that someone was still staring at him. He opened his eyes, and 13 glass eyes watched from the various shelves of Madame Tracy's boudoir, staring out from a variety of fuzzy faces. He looked away, and into the eyes of someone staring intently at him. It was him.
"Och," he thought in terror, "I'm having one of them out-of-your-body experiences. I can see my ain self. I'm a goner this time right enough."
He made frantic swimming motions in an effort to reach his own body, and then, as these things do, the perspectives clicked into place. Shadwell relaxed and wondered why anyone would want to put a mirror on his bedroom ceiling. He shook his head, baffled. He climbed out of the bed, pulled on his boots, and stood up warily. Something was missing. A cigarette. He thrust his hands deep into his pockets, pulled out a tin, and began to roll a cigarette. He'd been dreaming, he knew. Shadwell didn't remember the dream, but it made him feel uncomfortable, whatever it was. He lit the cigarette, and he saw his right hand, the ultimate weapon, the doomsday device. He pointed one finger at the one-eyed teddy bear on the mantelpiece. "Bang," he said, and chuckled dustily. He wasn't used to chuckling, and he began to cough, which meant he was back on familiar territory. He wanted something to drink, a sweet can of condensed milk. Madame Tracy would have some. He stomped out of her boudoir, heading toward the kitchen. Outside the little kitchen, he paused. She was talking to someone, a man.
"So, what exactly do you want me to do about this?" she was asking.
"Ach, ye beldam," muttered Shadwell.
She had one of her gentleman callers in there, obviously.
"To be frank, dear lady, my plans at this point are perforce somewhat fluid."
Shadwell's blood ran cold.
He marched through the bead curtain, shouting, "The sins of Sodom and Gomorrah, taken advantage of a defenseless whore, over my dead body."
Madame Tracy looked up and smiled at him. There wasn't anyone else in the room.
"Where is he?"
asked Shadwell.
"Whom?"
asked Madame Tracy.
"Some southern pansy," he said. "I heard him. He was in here suggesting things to you. I heard him."
Madame Tracy's mouth opened, and a voice said,
"Not just a southern pansy, Sergeant Shadwell.
The southern pansy."
Shadwell dropped his cigarette. He stretched out his arm, shaking slightly, and pointed his hand at Madame Tracy.
"Demon," he croaked.
"No,"
said Madame Tracy, in the voice of the demon. "Now, I know what you're thinking, Sergeant Shadwell. You're thinking that any second now, this head is going to go round and round, and I'm going to start vomiting pea soup. Well, I'm not. I'm not a demon. And I'd like you to listen to what I have to say."
"Demon spawn, be silent," ordered Shadwell. "I'll no listen to your wicked lies. Do you know what this is? It's a hand. Four fingers, one thumb. It's already exercised one of your number this morning. Now get ye out of this good woman's head, or I'll blast ye to kingdom come."
"That's the problem, Mr. Shadwell," said Madame Tracy in her own voice. "Kingdom come. It's going to. That's the problem. Mr. Aziraphale has been telling me all about it. Now stop being an old silly, Mr. Shadwell. Sit down and have some tea, and he'll explain it to you as well."
"I'll ne'er listen to his hellish blandishments, woman," said Shadwell.
Madame Tracy smiled at him.
"You old silly," she said.
He could have handled anything else. He sat down, but he didn't lower his hand. The swinging overhead signs proclaimed that the southbound carriageway was closed, and the small forest of orange cones had sprung up, redirecting motorists onto a co-opted lane of the northbound carriageway. Other signs directed motorists to slow down to 30 miles per hour. Police cars herded the drivers around like red-striped sheepdogs. The four bikers ignored all the signs and cones and police cars and continued down the empty southbound carriageway of the M6. The other four bikers, just behind them, slowed a little.
"Shouldn't we, stop or something?"
asked really cool people.
"Yeah, could be a pile-up,"
said Treading in Dog Shit, formerly All Foreigners, Especially the French, formerly Things Not Working Properly Even When You've Given Them a Good Thumping, never actually No Alcohol Lager, briefly Embarrassing Personal Problems, formerly known as Scuzz.
"We're the other four horsemen of the apocalypse," said GBH. "We do what they do. We follow them."
They rode south. It'll be a world just for us, said Adam. Everything's always been messed up by other people, but we can get rid of it all and start again. Won't that be great? You are, I trust, familiar with the Book of Revelation, said Madam Tracy with Azrael's voice.
I, said Shadwell, who wasn't.
His biblical expertise began and ended with Exodus, chapter 22, verse 18, which concerned witches, the suffering to live of, and why you shouldn't. He had once glanced at verse 19, which was about putting to death people who lay down with beasts, but he had felt that this was rather outside his jurisdiction. Then you have heard of the Antichrist?
I, said Shadwell,
who had seen a film once which explained it all, something about sheets of glass falling off lorries and slicing people's heads off, as he recalled. No proper witches to speak of. He'd gone to sleep halfway through. The Antichrist is alive on Earth at this moment, Sergeant. He is bringing about Armageddon, the Day of Judgment, even if he himself does not know it. Heaven and hell are both preparing for war, and it's all going to be very messy. Shadwell merely grunted. I am not actually permitted to act directly in this matter, Sergeant, but I am sure that you can see that the imminent destruction of the world is not something any reasonable man would permit. Am I correct?
I suppose,
said Shadwell, sipping condensed milk from a rusting can Madam Tracy had discovered under the sink. Then there is only one thing to be done, and you are the only man I can rely on. The Antichrist must be killed, Sergeant Shadwell, and you must do it. Shadwell frowned.
I wouldn't know about that, he said. The Witchfinder army only kills witches. 'Tis one of the rules. And demons and imps, of course.
But the Antichrist is more than just a witch. He's the witch.
He's just about as witchy as you can get.
Would he be harder to get rid of than, say, a demon?
Asked Shadwell, who had begun to brighten. Not much more, said Azrael, who had never done other to get rid of demons than to hint to them very strongly that he, Azrael, had some work to be getting on with, and wasn't it getting late? And Crowley had always got the hint. Shadwell looked down at his right hand and smiled. Then he hesitated.
This Antichrist, how many nipples has he?
The end justifies the means, thought Azrael, and the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Note, this is not actually true. The road to hell is paved with frozen door-to-door salesmen. On weekends, many of the younger demons go ice skating down it. End note. And he lied cheerfully and convincingly.
Oodles. Pots of them. His chest is covered with them. He makes Diana of the Ephesians look positively nippleless.
I wouldn't know about this Diana of yours, said Shadwell. But if he's a witch, and it sounds to me like he is, then, speaking as a sergeant in the W.A., I'm your man.
Good, said Azrael through Madam Tracy. I'm not sure about this killing business, said Madam Tracy herself, but if it's this man, this Antichrist, or everybody else, then I suppose we don't really have any choice.
Exactly, dear lady, she replied.
Now, Sergeant Shadwell, have you a weapon? Shadwell rubbed his right hand with his left, clenching and unclenching the fist.
I, he said, I have that.
And he raised two fingers to his lips and blew on them gently. There was a pause. Your hand? asked Azrafael.
Aye, 'tis a terrible weapon. It did for ye, demon spawn, did it not?
Have you anything more, substantial? How about the golden dagger of Megiddo, or the shiv of Kali?
Shadwell shook his head.
I've got some pins, he suggested, and the thunder gun of Witchfinder Colonel. Ye shall not eat any living thing with the blood, neither shall ye use enchantment nor observe time's Dalrymple. I could load it with silver bullets.
That's werewolves, I believe, said Azrafael.
Garlic?
Vampires?
Shadwell shrugged.
I dinna have any fancy bullets anyway, but the thunder gun will fire anything. I'll go and fetch it.
He shuffled out, thinking, why do I need another weapon? I'm a man with a hand.
Now, dear lady, said Azrafael, I trust you have a reliable mode of transportation at your disposal.
Oh, yes, said Madam Tracy. She went over to the corner of the kitchen and picked up a pink motorbike helmet with a yellow sunflower painted on it and put it on, strapping it under her chin. Then she rummaged in a cupboard, pulled out 300 or 400 plastic shopping bags and a heap of yellowing local newspapers, then a dusty day-glow green helmet with Easy Rider written across the top, a present from her niece Petula 20 years before. Shadwell, returning with a thunder gun over his shoulder, stared at her unbelieving.
I don't know what you're staring at, Mr. Shadwell, she told him. It's parked in the road downstairs.
She passed him the helmet. You've got to put it on. It's the law.
I don't think you're really allowed to have 3 people on a scooter, even if 2 of them are, sharing. But it's an emergency, and I'm sure you'll be quite safe if you hold on to me nice and tight.
And she smiled.
Won't that be fun?
Shadwell paled, muttered something inaudible, and put on the green helmet.
What was that, Mr. Shadwell?
Madam Tracy looked at him sharply.
I said, they'll ding a divot if you're wame with a flotter spade, said Shadwell.
That'll be quite enough of that kind of language, Mr. Shadwell, said Madam Tracy, and she marched him out of the hall and down the stairs to Crouch End High Street, where an elderly scooter waited to take the 2, well, call it 3 of them, away.
The lorry blocked the road, and the corrugated iron blocked the road, and a 30-foot-high pile of fish blocked the road. It was one of the most effectively blocked roads the sergeant had ever seen. The rain wasn't helping.
Any idea when the bulldozers are likely to get here?
He shouted into his radio.
We're doing the best we
came the reply. He felt something tugging at his trouser cuff and looked down.
Lobsters?
He gave a little skip and a jump and wound up on top of the police car.
Lobsters, he repeated.
There were about 30 of them, some over 2 feet long. Most of them were on their way up the motorway. Half a dozen had stopped to check out the police car.
"Something wrong, Sarge?"
asked the police constable, who was taking down the lorry driver's details on the hard shoulder.
"I just don't like lobsters," said the sergeant, grimly shutting his eyes. "Bring me out in a rash. Too many legs. I'll just sit up here a bit, and you can tell me when they've all gone."
He sat on the top of the car in the rain, and felt the water seeping into the bottom of his trousers. There was a low roar.
Thunder?
No, it was continuous. And getting closer. Motorbikes. The sergeant opened one eye.
Jesus Christ!
There were 4 of them, and they had to be doing over 100. He was about to climb down to wave at them, to shout, but they were past him, heading straight for the upturned lorry. There was nothing the sergeant could do. He closed his eyes again and listened for the collision. He could hear them coming closer. Then,
whoosh, whoosh, whoosh,
and a voice in his head that said, "I'll catch up with the rest of you."
"Did you see that?" asked really cool people. "They flew right over it." "Kinnell," said GBH, "if they can do it, we can too."
The sergeant opened his eyes. He turned to the police constable and opened his mouth. The police constable said,
They flew right..." Thud, thud, thud. Splat!
There was another rain of fish, although of shorter duration, and more easily explicable. A leather-jacketed arm waved feebly from the large pile of fish. A motorbike wheel spun hopelessly. That was Scuzz, semi-conscious, deciding that if there was one thing he hated even more than the French, it was being up to his neck in fish with what felt like a broken leg. He truly hated that. He wanted to tell GBH about his new role, but he couldn't move. Something wet and slippery slithered up one sleeve. Later, when they'd dragged him out of the fish pile, and he'd seen the other three bikers with the blankets over their heads, he realized it was too late to tell them anything. That was why they hadn't been in that Book of Revelations Pig Bog had been going on about. They'd never made it that far down the motorway. Scuzz muttered something. The police sergeant leaned over.
"Don't try to speak, son," he said. "The ambulance'll be here soon." "Listen," croaked Scuzz. "Got something important to tell you. The four horsemen of the apocalypse, they're right bastards, all four of them."
"He's delirious," announced the sergeant.
"I'm sodding not. I'm people covered in fish," croaked Scuzz, and passed out.
The London traffic system is many hundreds of times more complex than anyone imagines. This has nothing to do with influences, demonic or angelic. It's more to do with geography and history and architecture. Mostly, this works to people's advantage, although they'd never believe it. London was not designed for cars. Come to that, it wasn't designed for people. It just sort of happened. This created problems, and the solutions that were implemented became the next problems, 5 or 10 or 100 years down the line. The latest solution had been the M25, a motorway that formed a rough circle around the city. Up until now, the problems had been fairly basic, things like it being obsolete before they had finished building it, Einsteinian tailbacks that eventually became tail forwards, that kind of thing. The current problem was that it didn't exist. Not in normal human spatial terms, anyway. The tailback of cars unaware of this, or trying to find alternate routes out of London, stretched into the city center from every direction. For the first time ever, London was completely gridlocked. The city was one huge traffic jam. Cars, in theory, give you a terrifically fast method of traveling from place to place. Traffic jams, on the other hand, give you a terrific opportunity to stay still, in the rain and the gloom, while around you the cacophonous symphony of horns grew ever louder and more exasperated. Crowley was getting sick of it. He'd taken the opportunity to reread Aziraphale's notes and to thumb through Agnes Nutter's prophecies and to do some serious thinking. His conclusions could be summarized as follows. 1. Armageddon was underway. 2. There was nothing Crowley could do about this. 3. It was going to happen in Tadfield, or to begin there at any rate. After that, it was going to happen everywhere. 4. Crowley was in Hell's bad books. Note, not that Hell has any other kind. End note. 5. Aziraphale was, as far as could be estimated, out of the equation. 6. All was black, gloomy, and awful. There was no light at the end of the tunnel. Or, if there was, it was an oncoming train. 7. He might just as well find a nice little restaurant and get completely and utterly pissed out of his mind while he waited for the world to end. 8. And yet... And that was where it all fell apart. Because underneath it all, Crowley was an optimist. If there was one rock-hard certainty that had sustained him through the bad times, he thought briefly of the 14th century, then it was utter surety that he would come out on top, that the universe would look after him. Okay, so hell was down on him. So the world was ending. So the Cold War was over and the Great War was starting for real. So the odds against him were higher than a vanload of hippies on a blotter full of Owsley's old original. There was still a chance. It was all a matter of being in the right place at the right time. The right place was Tadfield. He was certain of that. Partly from the book, partly from some other sense. In Crowley's mental map of the world, Tadfield was throbbing like a migraine. The right time was getting there before the end of the world. He checked his watch. He had 2 hours to get to Tadfield, although probably even the normal passage of time was pretty shaky by now. Crowley tossed the book into the passenger seat. Desperate times, desperate measures. He had maintained the Bentley without a scratch for 60 years. What the hell? He reversed suddenly, causing severe damage to the front of the red Renault 5 behind him, and drove up onto the pavement. He turned on his lights and sounded his horn. That should give any pedestrian sufficient warning that he was coming. And if they couldn't get out of the way, well, it'd all be the same in a couple of hours. Maybe. Probably. "Hi-ho," said Anthony Crowley, and just drove away. There were 6 women and 4 men, and each of them had a telephone and a thick wadge of computer printout, covered with names and telephone numbers. By each of the numbers was a penned notation saying whether the person dialed was in or out, whether the number was currently connected, and, most importantly, whether or not anybody who answered the phone was avid for cavity wall insulation to enter their lives. Most of them weren't. The 10 people sat there, hour after hour, cajoling, pleading, promising through plastic smiles. Between calls, they made notations, sipped coffee, and marveled at the rain flooding down the windows. They were staying at their posts like the band on the Titanic. If you couldn't sell double glazing in weather like this, you couldn't sell it at all. Lisa Morrow was saying, "Now, if you'll only let me finish, sir, and yes, I understand that, sir, but if you'll only..." And then, seeing that he'd just hung up on her, she said, "Well, up yours, Snotface." She put down the phone. "I got another bath," she announced to her fellow telephone salespersons. She was well in the lead in the office daily getting people out of the bath stakes, and only needed 2 more points to win the weekly Coitus Interruptus Award. She dialed the next number on the list. Lisa had never intended to be a telephone salesperson. What she really wanted to be was an internationally glamorous jet-setter, but she didn't have the O-levels. Had she been studious enough to be accepted as an internationally glamorous jet-setter, or a dental assistant, her second choice of profession, or indeed anything other than a telephone salesperson in that particular office, she would have had a longer and probably more fulfilled life. Perhaps not a very much longer life, all things considered, it being the day of Armageddon, but several hours anyway. For that matter, all she really needed to do for a longer life was not ring the number she had just dialed, listed on her sheet as the Mayfair home of, in the best traditions of tenth-hand mail-order lists, Mr. A. J. Cowley. But she had dialed, and she had waited while it rang four times. And she had said, "Oh, poot, another answerphone," and started to put down the handset. But then something climbed out of the earpiece, something very big and very angry. It looked a little like a maggot, a huge, angry maggot made out of thousands and thousands of tiny little maggots, all writhing and screaming, millions of little maggot mouths opening and shutting in fury, and every one of them was screaming, "Crowley!" It stopped screaming, swayed blindly, seemed to be taking stock of where it was. Then it went to pieces. The thing split into thousands of writhing gray maggots. They flowed over the carpet, up over the desks, over Lisa Morrow and her nine colleagues. They flowed into their mouths, up their nostrils, into their lungs. They burrowed into flesh and eyes and brains and lights, reproducing wildly as they went, filling the room with a towering mess of writhing flesh and gunk. The whole began to flow together, to coagulate into one huge entity that filled the room from floor to ceiling, pulsing gently. A mouth opened in the mass of flesh, strands of something wet and sticky adhering to each of the not exactly lips, and Haster said, "I needed that." Spending half an hour trapped on an answerphone with only Azrafael's message for company had not improved his temper. Neither did the prospect of having to report back to hell and having to explain why he hadn't returned half an hour earlier, and more importantly, why he was not accompanied by Crowley. Hell did not go a bundle on failures. On the plus side, however, he at least knew what Azrafael's message was. The knowledge could probably buy him his continued existence. And anyway, he reflected, if he were going to have to face the possible wrath of the Dark Council, at least it wouldn't be on an empty stomach. The room filled with thick, sulfurous smoke. When it cleared, Haster was gone. There was nothing left in the room but 10 skeletons, picked quite clean of meat, and some puddles of melted plastic with, here and there, a gleaming fragment of metal that might once have been part of a telephone. Much better to have been a dental assistant. But, to look on the bright side, all this only went to prove that evil contains the seeds of its own destruction. Right now, across the country, people who would otherwise have been made just that little bit more tense and angry by being summoned from a nice bath, or having their names mispronounced at them, were instead feeling quite untroubled and at peace with the world. As a result of Haster's action, a wave of low-grade goodness started to spread exponentially through the population, and millions of people who ultimately would have suffered minor bruises of the soul did not, in fact, do so. So, that was all right. You wouldn't have known it as the same car. There was scarcely an inch of it undented. Both front lights were smashed. The hubcaps were long gone. It looked like the veteran of 100 demolition derbies. The pavements had been bad. The pedestrian underpass had been worse. The worst bit had been crossing the River Thames. At least he'd had the foresight to roll up all the windows. Still, he was here, now. In a few hundred yards, he'd be on the M40, a fairly clear run up to Oxfordshire. There was only one snag. Once more between Crowley and the open road was the M25, a screaming, glowing ribbon of pain and dark light. Note, not actually an oxymoron. It's the color past ultraviolet. The technical term for it is infra-black. It can be seen quite easily under experimental conditions. To perform the experiment, simply select a healthy brick wall with a good run-up and, lowering your head, charge. The color that flashes in bursts behind your eyes, behind the pain, just before you die, is infra-black. End note. Odegra. Nothing could cross it and survive. Nothing mortal, anyway. And he wasn't sure what it would do to a demon. It couldn't kill him, but it wouldn't be pleasant. There was a police roadblock in front of the flyover before him. Burnt-out wrecks, some still burning, testified to the fate of previous cars that had to drive across the flyover above the dark road. The police did not look happy. Crowley shifted down into second gear and gunned the accelerator. He went through the roadblock at 60. That was the easy bit. Cases of spontaneous human combustion are on record all over the world. One minute, someone's quite happily chugging along with their life. The next, there's a sad photograph of a pile of ashes and a lonely and mysteriously uncharred foot or hand. Cases of spontaneous vehicular combustion are less well documented. Whatever the statistics were, they had just gone up by one. The leather seat covers began to smoke. Staring ahead of him, Crowley fumbled left-handedly on the passenger seat for Agnes Nutter's nice and accurate prophecies, moved it to the safety of his lap. He wished she'd prophesied this. Note, she had. It read, "A street of light will scream, the black chariot of the serpent will flame, and a queen will sing quicksilver songs no more." Most of the family had gone along with Gelatli Device, who wrote a brief monograph in the 1830s, explaining it as a metaphor for the banishment of Weishaupt's Illuminati from Bavaria in 1785. End note. Then the flames engulfed the car. He had to keep driving. On the other side of the flyover was a further police roadblock. To prevent the passage of cars trying to come into London. They were laughing about a story that had just come over the radio, that a motorbike cop on the M6 had flagged down a stolen police car only to discover the driver to be a large octopus. Some police forces would believe anything. Not the Metropolitan Police, though. The Met was the hardest, most cynically pragmatic, most stubbornly down-to-earth police force in Britain. It would take a lot to phase a copper from the Met. It would take, for example, a huge battered car that was nothing more nor less than a fireball, a blazing, roaring, twisted metal lemon from hell, driven by a grinning lunatic in sunglasses, sitting amid the flames, trailing thick black smoke, coming straight at them through the lashing rain and the wind at 80 miles per hour. That would do it every time. The quarry was the calm center of a stormy world. Thunder didn't just rumble overhead. It tore the air in half. "I've got some more friends coming," Adam repeated. "They'll be here soon, and then we can really get started." Dogs started to howl. It was no longer the siren howl of a lone wolf, but the weird oscillations of a small dog in deep trouble. Pepper had been sitting staring at her knees. There seemed to be something on her mind. Finally, she looked up and stared at him in the blank gray eyes. "What bit are you going to have, Adam?" she said. The storm was replaced by a sudden, ringing silence.
What?
Said Adam.
Well, you divided up the world, right? And we've all of us got to have a bit. What bit are you going to have?
The silence sang like a harp, high and thin.
Yeah, said Brian. You never told us what bit you're having.
Pepper's right, said Wensleydale.
Don't seem to me there's much left, if we've got to have all these countries.
Adam's mouth opened and shut.
What?
He said.
What bit's yours, Adam?
Said Pepper. Adam stared at her. Dog had stopped howling, and had fixed his master with an intent, thoughtful, mongrel stare.
Me?
He said. The silence went on and on. One note that could drown out the noises of the world.
But I'll have Tadfield, said Adam.
They stared at him.
And Lower Tadfield? And Norton? And Norton Woods?
They still stared. Adam's gaze dragged itself across their faces.
They're all I've ever wanted, he said.
They shook their heads.
I can have 'em if I want,
said Adam, his voice tinged with sullen defiance, and his defiance edged with sudden doubt.
I can make them better, too. Better trees to climb, better ponds, better...
His voice trailed off.
You can't, said Wensleydale flatly. They're not like America in those places. They're really real. Anyway, they belong to all of us. They're ours. And you couldn't make 'em better, said Brian. Anyway, even if you did, we'd all know, said Pepper. Oh, if that's all that's worrying you, don't you worry, said Adam airily. 'Cause I could make you all just do whatever I wanted.
He stopped, his ears listening in horror to the words his mouth was speaking. The them were backing away. Dog put his paws over his head. Adam's face looked like an impersonation of the collapse of empire.
No, he said hoarsely. No, come back. I command you.
They froze in mid-dash. Adam stared.
No, I didn't mean it, he began. You're my friends.
His body jerked. His head was thrown back. He raised his arms and pounded the sky with his fists. His face twisted. The chalk floor cracked under his sneakers. Adam opened his mouth and screamed. It was a sound that a merely mortal throat should not have been able to utter. It wound out of the quarry, mingled with the storm, caused the clouds to curdle into new and unpleasant shapes. It went on and on. It resounded around the universe, which is a good deal smaller than physicists would believe. It rattled the celestial spheres. It spoke of loss, and it did not stop for a very long time. And then it did. Something drained away. Adam's head tilted down again. His eyes opened. Whatever had been standing in the old quarry before, Adam Young was standing there now. A more knowledgeable Adam Young, but Adam Young nevertheless. Possibly more of Adam Young than there had ever been before. The ghastly silence in the quarry was replaced by a more familiar, comfortable silence. The mere and simple absence of noise. The freed them cowered against the chalk cliff, their eyes fixed on him.
It's all right, said Adam quietly.
Pepper?
Wensley?
Brian?
Come back here.
It's all right.
It's all right. I know everything now, and you've got to help me. Otherwise, it's all going to happen. It's really all going to happen. It's all going to happen if we don't do something. The plumbing in Jasmine Cottage heaved and rattled and showered Newt with water that was slightly khaki in color, but it was cold. It was probably the coldest cold shower Newt had ever had in his life. It didn't do any good. "There's a red sky," he said when he came back. He was feeling slightly manic. At 4:30 in the afternoon, in August. What does that mean? In terms of delighted nautical operatives, would you say? I mean, if it takes a red sky at night to delight a sailor, what does it take to amuse the man who operates the computers on a supertanker? Or is it shepherds who are delighted at night? I can never remember. Anathema eyed the plaster in his hair. The shower hadn't got rid of it. It had merely dampened it down and spread it out, so that Newt looked as though he was wearing a white hat with hair in it. "You must have got quite a bump," she said. "No, that was when I hit my head on the wall. You know, when you..." "Yes?" Anathema looked quizzically out of the broken window. "Would you say it's blood-colored?" she said. "It's very important." "I wouldn't say that," said Newt, his train of thought temporarily derailed. "Not actual blood, more pinkish. Probably the storm put a lot of dust in the air." Anathema was rummaging through the nice and accurate prophecies. "What are you doing?" he said. "Trying to cross-reference. I still can't be..." "I don't think you need to bother," said Newt. "I know what the rest of 3,477 means. It came to me when I..." "What do you mean? You know what it means." "I saw it on my way down here. And don't snap like that. My head aches. I mean, I saw it. They've got it written down outside that airbase of yours. It's got nothing to do with peas. It's peace is our profession. It's the kind of thing they put up on boards outside airbases. You know, SAC 8,657,745th Wing, the Screaming Blue Demons, peace is our profession. That sort of thing." Newt clutched his head. The euphoria was definitely fading. "If Agnes is right, then there's probably some madman in there right now, winding up all the missiles and cranking open the launch windows, or whatever they are." "No, there isn't," said Anathema firmly. "Oh, yes, I've seen films. Name me one good reason why you can be so sure." "There aren't any bombs there, or missiles. Everyone round here knows that." "But it's an airbase. It's got runways." "That's just for transport planes and things. All they've got up there is communications gear, radios and stuff. Nothing explosive at all." Newt stared at her. "Look at Crowley, doing 110 miles per hour on the M40 heading toward Oxfordshire." Even the most resolutely casual observer would notice a number of strange things about him. The clenched teeth, for example, or the dull red glow coming from behind his sunglasses. And the car. The car was a definite hint. Crowley had started the journey in his Bentley, and he was damned if he wasn't going to finish it in the Bentley as well. Not that even the kind of car buff who owns his own pair of motoring goggles would have been able to tell it was a vintage Bentley. Not anymore. They wouldn't have been able to tell that it was a Bentley. They would only offer 50-50 that it had ever even been a car. There was no paint left on it, for a start. It might still have been black, for it wasn't a rusty, smudged reddish-brown. But this was a dull, charcoal black. It traveled in its own ball of flame, like a space capsule, making a particularly difficult re-entry. There was a thin skin of crusted, melted rubber left around the metal wheel rims. But seeing that the wheel rims were still somehow riding an inch above the road surface, this didn't seem to make an awful lot of difference to the suspension. It should have fallen apart miles back.
It was the effort of holding it together that was causing Crowley to grit his teeth, and the biospatial feedback that was causing the bright red eyes. That, and the effort of having to remember not to start breathing. He hadn't felt like this since the 14th century. The atmosphere in the quarry was friendlier now, but still intense.
"You've got to help me sort it out," said Adam. "People have been trying to sort it out for thousands of years, but we've got to sort it out now."
They nodded helpfully.
"You see, the thing is," said Adam, "this thing is, it's like, well, you know, Greasy Johnson."
The femme nodded. They all knew Greasy Johnson and the members of the other gang in Lower Tadfield. They were older and not very pleasant. Hardly a week went by without a skirmish.
"Well," said Adam, "we always win, right?"
"Nearly always," said Wensley Dale.
"Nearly always," said Adam. "And?"
"More than half, anyway," said Pepper. "'Cause you remember when there was all that fuss over the old folks' party in the village hall when we—"
"That doesn't count," said Adam. "They got told off just as much as us. Anyway, old folks are supposed to like listening to the sound of children playing. I read that somewhere. I don't see why we should get told off, 'cause we've got the wrong kind of old folks."
He paused.
"Anyway, we're better'n them."
"Oh, we're better'n them," said Pepper. "You're right about that. We're better'n them, all right. We just don't always win."
"Just suppose," said Adam slowly, "that we could beat 'em properly. Get them sent away or something. Just make sure there's no more old gangs in Lower Tadfield apart from us. What do you think about that?"
"What? You mean he'd be dead?" said Brian.
"No, just gone away."
The them thought about this. Greasy Johnson had been a fact of life ever since they'd been old enough to hit one another with a toy railway engine. They tried to get their minds around the concept of a world with a Johnson-shaped hole in it. Brian scratched his nose.
"I reckon it'd be brilliant without Greasy Johnson," he said. "Remember what he did at my birthday party? And I got into trouble about it."
"I don't know," said Pepper. "I mean, it wouldn't be so interesting without old Greasy Johnson and his gang. When you think about it, we've had a lot of fun with old Greasy Johnson and the Johnsonites. We'd probably have to find some other gang or something."
"Seems to me," said Wensley Dale, "that if you ask people in Lower Tadfield, they'd say they'd be better off without the Johnsonites or the them."
Even Adam looked shocked at this. Wensley Dale went on stoically.
"The old folks' club would, and Picky, and—"
"But we're the good ones," Brian began.
He hesitated.
"Well, all right," he said. "But I bet they'd think it'd be a jolly sight less interesting if we all weren't here."
"Yes," said Wensley Dale. "That's what I mean. People round here don't want us or the Johnsonites," he went on morosely. "The way they're always going on about us just riding our bikes or skateboarding on their pavements and making too much noise and stuff. It's like the man said in the history books, 'A plaque on both your houses.'"
This met with silence.
"One of those blue ones," said Brian eventually, "saying Adam Young lived here or something."
Normally, an opening like this could lead to 5 minutes rambling discussion when the them were in the mood, but Adam felt that this was not the time.
"What you're all saying," he summed up in his best chairman tones, "is that
it wouldn't be any good at all if the greasy Johnsonites beat the them, or the other way round?
That's right, said Pepper.
Because, she added, if we beat them, we'd have to be our own deadly enemies. It'd be me and Adam against Brian and Wensley.
She sat back. Everyone needs a greasy Johnson, she said.
Yeah, said Adam. That's what I thought. It's no good anyone winning. That's what I thought.
He stared at Dog, or through Dog.
Seems simple enough to me, said Wensleydale, sitting back. I don't see why it's taken thousands of years to sort out.
That's because the people trying to sort it out were men, said Pepper meaningfully.
Don't see why you have to take sides, said Wensleydale.
Of course I have to take sides, said Pepper. Everyone has to take sides in something.
Adam appeared to reach a decision.
Yes, but I reckon you can make your own side. I think you'd better go and get your bikes, he said quietly. I think we'd better sort of go and talk to some people.
Put, 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 with Madam Tracy's motor scooter down Crouch End High Street. It was the only vehicle moving on a suburban London street, jammed with immobile cars and taxis and red London buses.
I've never seen a traffic jam like it, said Madam Tracy. I wonder if there's been an accident.
Quite possibly, said Aziraphale.
And then,
Mr. Shadwell, unless you put your arms round me, you're going to fall off. This thing wasn't built for two people, you know.
Three, muttered Shadwell, gripping the seat with one white-knuckled hand and his thunder gun with the other.
Mr. Shadwell, I won't tell you again.
You'll have to stop, then, so as I can adjust me weapon, sighed Shadwell.
Madam Tracy giggled dutifully, but she pulled over to the curb and stopped the motor scooter. Shadwell sorted himself out and put two grudging arms around Madam Tracy, while the thunder gun stuck up between them like a chaperone. They rode through the rain without talking for another 10 minutes.
Put, 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 put,
as Madam Tracy carefully negotiated her way around the cars and the buses. Madam Tracy found her eyes being moved down to the speedometer. Rather foolishly, she thought, since it hadn't worked since 1974, and it hadn't worked very well before that.
"Dear lady, how fast would you say we were going?" asked Aziraphale.
"Why?"
"Because it seems to me that we would go slightly faster walking."
"Well, with just me on, the top speed is about 15 miles an hour, but with Mr. Shadwell as well, it must be, about 4 or 5 miles per hour. She interrupted.
"I suppose so," she agreed. There was a cough from behind her.
"Can ye no slow down this hellish machine, woman?" asked an ashen voice.
In the infernal pantheon, which it goes without saying Shadwell hated uniformly and correctly, Shadwell reserved a special loathing for speed demons.
"In which case," said Aziraphale, "we will get to Tadfield in something less than 10 hours.
There was a pause from Madam Tracy. Then, "How far away is this Tadfield, anyway?"
"About 40 miles.
Said Madam Tracy, who had once driven the scooter the few miles to nearby Finchley to visit her niece, but had taken the bus since, because of the funny noises the scooter had started making on the way back.
"We should really be going at about 70, if we're going to get there in time," said Aziraphale. "Sergeant Shadwell, hold on very tightly now."
Put, 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 and a blue nimbus began to outline the scooter and its occupants with a gentle sort of a glow, like an afterimage, all around them. putt, 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 and the scooter lifted awkwardly off the ground, with no visible means of support, jerking slightly until it reached a height of 5 feet, more or less. "Don't look down, Sergeant Shadwell," advised Azrafael. Said Shadwell, eyes screwed tightly shut, gray forehead beaded with sweat, not looking down, not looking anywhere. "And off we go, then." In every big-budget science fiction movie, there's the moment when a spaceship as large as New York suddenly goes to light speed. A twanging noise, like a wooden ruler being plucked over the edge of a desk, a dazzling refraction of light, and suddenly the stars have all been stretched out thin, and it's gone. This was exactly like that, except that instead of a gleaming 12-mile-long spaceship, it was an off-white 20-year-old motor scooter. And you didn't have the special rainbow effects. And it probably wasn't going at more than 200 miles an hour. And instead of a pulsing whine sliding up the octaves, it just went putt, 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 whoosh! But it was exactly like that anyway. Where the M-25, now a screaming frozen circle, intersects with the M-40 to Oxfordshire, police were clustered around in ever-increasing quantities. Since Crowley crossed the divide half an hour earlier, their number had doubled. On the M40 side, anyway. No one in London was getting out. In addition to the police, there were also approximately 200 others standing around and inspecting the M25 through binoculars. They included representatives from Her Majesty's Army, the Bomb Disposal Squad, MI5, MI6, the Special Branch, and the CIA. There was also a man selling hot dogs. Everybody was cold and wet and puzzled and irritable, with the exception of one police officer, who was cold, wet, puzzled, irritable, and exasperated. "Look, I don't care if you believe me or not," he sighed. "All I'm telling you is what I saw. It was an old car, a Rolls or a Bentley, one of those flash vintage jobs, and it made it over the bridge." One of the senior army technicians interrupted. "It can't have done. According to our instruments, the temperature above the M25 is somewhere in excess of 700 degrees centigrade. "Or 140 degrees below," added his assistant. "Or 140 degrees below zero," agreed the senior technician. "There does appear to be some confusion on that score, although I think we can safely attribute it to mechanical error of some kind." Note, this was true. There wasn't a thermometer on Earth that could have been persuaded to register both 700 degrees centigrade and minus 140 degrees centigrade at the same time, which was the correct temperature. End note. "But the fact remains that we can't even get a helicopter directly over the M25 without winding up with helicopter McNuggets. How on earth can you tell me that a vintage car drove over it unharmed?" "I didn't say it drove over it unharmed," corrected the policeman, who was thinking seriously about leaving the Metropolitan Police and going into business with his brother, who was resigning his job with the electricity board and was going to start breeding chickens. "It burst into flames. It just kept on going." "Do you seriously expect any of us to believe?" began somebody. A high-pitched keening noise, haunting and strange, like a thousand glass harmonicas being played in unison, all slightly off-key, like the sound of the molecules of the air itself wailing in pain. And whoosh! Over their heads it sailed, 40 feet in the air, engulfed in a deep blue nimbus which faded to red at the edges. A little white motor scooter, and riding it, a middle-aged woman in a pink helmet, and holding tightly to her a short man in a Macintosh and a day-glow green crash helmet. The motor scooter was too far up for anyone to see that his eyes were tightly shut, but they were. The woman was screaming. What she was screaming was this.
Geronimo!
One of the advantages of the Wasabi, as Newt was always keen to point out, was that when it was badly damaged, it was very hard to tell. Newt had to keep driving Dick Turpin onto the shoulder to avoid fallen branches. You've made me drop all the cards on the floor. The car thumped back onto the road. A small voice from somewhere under the glove compartment said,
Oil pressure alert.
I'll never be able to sort them out now, she moaned. You don't have to, said Newt manically. Just pick one, anyone. It won't matter.
What do you mean?
Well, if Agnes is right, and we're doing all this because she's predicted it, then any card picked right now has got to be relevant. That's logic.
It's nonsense.
Yeah? Look, you're even here because she predicted it. And have you thought what we're going to say to the Colonel? If we get to see him, which of course we won't. If we're reasonable. Listen, I know these kinds of places. They have huge guards made out of teak guarding the gates, anathema. And they have white helmets and real guns, you understand, which fire real bullets made of real lead, which can go right into you and bounce around and come out of the same hole before you could even say, Excuse me, we have reason to believe that World War III is due any moment, and they're going to do the show right here. And then they have serious men in suits with bulging jackets who take you into a little room without windows and ask you questions like, Are you now, or have you ever been, a member of a pinko subversive organization, such as any British political party? And
we're nearly there.
Look, it's got gates and wire fences and everything, and probably the kind of dogs that eat people. I think you're getting rather overexcited, said Anathema quietly, picking the last of the file cards up from the floor of the car. Overexcited? No, I'm getting very calmly worried that someone might shoot me. I'm sure Agnes would have mentioned it if we were going to be shot. She's very good at that sort of thing. She began absent-mindedly to shuffle the file cards. You know, she said, carefully cutting the cards and riffling the two piles together, I read somewhere that there's a sect that believes that computers are the tools of the devil. They say that Armageddon will come about because of the Antichrist being good with computers. Apparently it's mentioned somewhere in Revelations. I think I must have read about it in a newspaper recently. Daily Mail. Letter from America. August the 3rd, said Newt. Just after the story about the woman in Worms, Nebraska, who taught her duck to play the accordion. Said Anathema, spreading the cards face down on her lap. So computers are tools of the devil? Thought Newt. He had no problem believing it. Computers had to be the tools of somebody, and all he knew for certain was that it definitely wasn't him. The car jerked to a halt. The air base looked battered. Several large trees had fallen down near the entrance, and some men with a digger were trying to shift them. The guard on duty was watching them disinterestedly, but he half-turned and looked coldly at the car. All right, said Newt. Pick a card. 3001. Behind the eagle's nest, a great ash hath fallen. Is that all?
Yes. We always thought it was something to do with the Russian Revolution. Keep going along this road and turn left.
The turning led to a narrow lane, with the base's perimeter fence on the left-hand side. And now pull in here. There's often cars here, and no one takes any notice, said Anathema. What is this place? It's the local lover's lane. Is that why it appears to be paved with rubber? They walked along the hedge-shaded lane for 100 yards until they reached the ash tree. Agnes had been right. It was quite great. It had fallen right across the fence. A guard was sitting on it, smoking a cigarette. He was black. Newt always felt guilty in the presence of black Americans, in case they blamed him for 200 years of slave trading. The man stood up when they approached, and then sagged into an easier stance. "Oh, hi, Anathema," he said. "Hi, George. Terrible storm, wasn't it?"
"Sure was."
They walked on. He watched them out of sight.
"You know him?" said Newt with forced nonchalance.
"Oh, sure. Sometimes a few of them come down to the pub. Pleasant enough in a well-scrubbed way."
"Would he shoot us if we just walked in?" said Newt.
"He might well point a gun at us in a menacing way," Anathema conceded.
"That's good enough for me. What do you suggest we do then?"
"Well, Agnes must have known something, so I suppose we just wait. It's not too bad now, the wind's gone down."
"Oh." Newt looked at the clouds piling up on the horizon.
"Good old Agnes," he said.
Adam pedaled steadily along the road, dog running along behind, and occasionally trying to bite his back tire out of sheer excitement. There was a clacking noise, and Pepper swung out of her drive. You could always tell Pepper's bike. She thought it was improved by a piece of cardboard cunningly held against the wheel by a clothes peg. Katz had learned to take evasive action when she was 2 streets away.
"I reckon we can cut along Drover's Lane and then up through Roundhead Woods," said Pepper.
"Saw muddy," said Adam.
"That's right," said Pepper nervously. "It gets all muddy up there. We ought to go along by the chalk pit. Saw is dry because of the chalk, and then up by the sewage farm."
Brian and Wensleydale pulled in behind them. Wensleydale's bicycle was black and shiny and sensible. Brian's might have been white once, but its color was lost beneath a thick layer of mud.
"It's stupid calling it a military base," said Pepper. "I went up there when they had that open day, and they had no guns or missiles or anything. Just knobs and dials and brass bands playing."
"Yes," said Adam. "Not much military about knobs and dials," said Pepper.
"I dunno, really," said Adam. "It's amazing what you can do with knobs and dials."
"I got a kit for Christmas," Wensleydale volunteered. "All electric bits. There were a few knobs and dials in it. You could make a radio or a thing that goes beep."
"I dunno," said Adam thoughtfully. "I'm thinking more of certain people patching into the worldwide military communications network and telling all the computers and stuff to start fighting."
"Core," said Brian. "That'd be wicked."
"Sort of," said Adam.
It is a high and lonely destiny to be chairman of the Lower Tadfield Residents Association. R.P. Tyler, short, well-fed, satisfied, stomped down a country lane, accompanied by his wife's miniature poodle, Schutzi. R.P. Tyler knew the difference between right and wrong. There were no moral grays of any kind in his life. He was not, however, satisfied simply with being vouchsafed the difference between right and wrong. He felt it his bounden duty to tell the world. Not for R.P. Tyler the soapbox, the polemic verse, the broadsheet,
R.P. Tyler's chosen forum was the letter column of the Tadfield Advertiser. If a neighbor's tree was inconsiderate enough to shed leaves into R.P. Tyler's garden, R.P. Tyler would first carefully sweep them all up, place them in boxes, and leave the boxes outside his neighbor's front door with a stern note. Then he would write a letter to the Tadfield Advertiser. If he sighted teenagers sitting on the village green, their portable cassette players playing, and they were enjoying themselves, he would take it upon himself to point out to them the error of their ways. And after he had fled their jeering, he would write to the Tadfield Advertiser on the decline of morality and the youth of today. Since his retirement last year, the letters had increased to the point where not even the Tadfield Advertiser was able to print all of them. Indeed, the letter R.P. Tyler had completed before setting out on his evening walk had begun. Sirs, I note with distress that the newspapers of today no longer feel obligated to their public, we the people who pay your wages. He surveyed the fallen branches that littered the narrow country road. I don't suppose, he pondered, they think of the cleaning up bill when they send us these storms. Parish council has to foot the bill to clean it all up, and we, the taxpayers, pay their wages. The they, in this thought, were the weather forecasters on Radio 4. Note. He did not have a television, or, as his wife put it, Ronald wouldn't have one of those things in the house, would you, Ronald? And he always agreed. Although secretly, he would have liked to have seen some of the smut and filth and violence that the National Viewers and Listeners Association complained of. Not because he wanted to see it, of course, just because he wanted to know what other people should be protected from. End note. Whom R.P. Tyler blamed for the weather. Schutze stopped by a roadside beech tree to cock its leg. R.P. Tyler looked away, embarrassed. It might be that the sole purpose of his evening constitutional was to allow the dog to relieve itself, but he was dashed if he'd admit that to himself. He stared up at the storm clouds. They were banked up high, in towering piles of smudged gray and black. It wasn't just the flickering tongues of lightning that forked through them like the opening sequence of a Frankenstein movie. It was the way they stopped when they reached the borders of Lower Tadfield. And in their center was a circular patch of daylight. But the light had a stretched yellow quality to it, like a forced smile. It was so quiet. There was a low roaring. Down the narrow lane came four motorbikes. They shot past him and turned the corner, disturbing a cock pheasant who whirred across the lane in a nervous arc of russet and green. Vandals! Called R.P. Tyler after them. The countryside wasn't made for people like them. It was made for people like him. He jerked Schutze's lead, and they marched along the road. 5 minutes later, he turned the corner to find three of the motorcyclists standing around a fallen signpost, a victim of the storm. The fourth, a tall man with a mirrored visor, remained on his bike. R.P. Tyler observed the situation and leaped effortlessly to a conclusion. These vandals, he had of course been right, had come to the countryside in order to desecrate the war memorial and to overturn signposts. He was about to advance on them sternly when it came to him that he was outnumbered, 4-1. And that they were taller than he was, and that they were undoubtedly violent psychopaths. No one but a violent psychopath rode motorbikes in R.P. Tyler's world. So he raised his chin and began to strut past them, without apparently noticing they were there. Note. Although, as a member, Reed founder, of his local neighborhood watch scheme, he did attempt to memorize the motorbike's number plates. End note.
all the while composing in his head a letter. "Sirs, this evening I noted with distress a large number of hooligans on motor bicycles infesting our fair village. Why, oh, why does the government do nothing about this plague of—"
"Hi," said one of the motorcyclists, raising his visor to reveal a thin face and a trim black beard. "We're kind of lost."
"Ah," said R.P. Tyler disapprovingly.
"The signpost must have blew down," said the motorcyclist.
"Yes, I suppose it must," agreed R.P. Tyler. He noticed with surprise that he was getting hungry.
"Yeah, well, we're heading for Lower Tadfield."
An officious eyebrow raised. "You're Americans, with the Air Force base, I suppose."
"Sirs, when I did national service, I was a credit to my country. I notice with horror and dismay that airmen from the Tadfield Air Base are driving around our noble countryside dressed no better than common thugs. While I appreciate their importance in defending the freedom of the Western world—"
Then his love of giving instructions took over.
"You go back down that road for half a mile, then first left—" "It's in a deplorable state of disrepair, I'm afraid. I've written numerous letters to the council about it." "Are you civil servants or civil masters? That's what I asked them. After all, who pays your wages?" "Then second right. Only it's not exactly right. It's on the left, but you'll find it bends round toward the right eventually. It's signposted Porritt's Lane. But, of course, it isn't Porritt's Lane. You look at the Ordnance Survey map, you'll see it's simply the eastern end of Forest Hill Lane. You'll come out in the village. Now you go past the Bull and Fiddle. That's a public house. Then when you get to the church—" I have pointed out to the people who compile the Ordnance Survey map that it's a church with a spire, not a church with a tower. Indeed, I have written to the Tadfield Advertiser, suggesting they mount a local campaign to get the map corrected. And I have every hope that once these people realize with whom they are dealing, you'll see a hasty U-turn from them. Then you'll get to a crossroads. Now, you go straight across that crossroads, and you'll immediately come to a second crossroads. Now, you can take either the left-hand fork or go straight on. Either way, you'll arrive at the air base, although the left-hand fork is almost a tenth of a mile shorter, and you can't miss it."
Famine stared at him blankly.
"I'm not sure I got that," he began.
"I did. Let us go."
Schutze gave a little yelp and darted behind R.P. Tyler, where it remained, shivering. The strangers climbed back onto their bikes. The one in white—a hippie by the look of him, thought R.P. Tyler—dropped an empty crisp packet onto the grass shoulder.
"Excuse me," barked Tyler. "Is that your crisp packet?"
"Oh, it's not just mine," said the boy. "It's everybody's." R.P. Tyler drew himself up to his full height. Note: 5'6". End note. "Young man," he said, "how would you feel if I came over to your house and dropped litter everywhere?"
Pollution smiled wistfully. "Very, very pleased," he breathed.
"Oh, that would be wonderful."
Beneath his bike, an oil slick puddled a rainbow on the wet road. Engines revved.
"I missed something," said War. "Now, why are we meant to make a U-turn by the church?"
"Just follow me," said the tall one in front, and the four rode off together.
R.P. Tyler stared after them, until his attention was distracted by the sound of something going clack, clack, clack. He turned. Four figures on bicycles shot past him, closely followed by the scampering figure of a small dog.
"You! Stop!"
shouted R.P. Tyler. The them braked to a halt and looked at him.
I knew it was you, Adam Young, and your little cabal. What, might I inquire, are you children doing out at this time of night? Do your fathers know you're out?
The leader of the cyclists turned. I can't see how you can say it's late, he said.
Seems to me, that if the sun's still out, then it's not late.
It's past your bedtime, anyway, R.P. Tyler informed them.
And don't stick out your tongue at me, young lady.
This was to Pepper.
Or I will be writing a letter to your mother informing her of the lamentable and unladylike state of her offspring's manners.
Well, excuse us, said Adam, aggrieved. Pepper was just looking at you.
I didn't know there was any law against looking.
There was a commotion in the grass. Schutze, who was a particularly refined toy French poodle, of the kind only possessed by people who were never able to fit children into their household budgets, was being menaced by Dog.
Master Young, ordered R.P. Tyler, please get your mutt away from my Schutze.
Tyler did not trust Dog. When he had first met the dog 3 days ago, it had snarled at him and glowed its eyes red. This had impelled Tyler to begin a letter pointing out that Dog was undoubtedly rabid, certainly a danger to the community, and should be put down for the general good, until his wife had reminded him that glowing red eyes weren't a symptom of rabies, or, for that matter, anything seen outside of the kind of film that neither of the Tylers would be caught dead at, but knew all they needed to know about, thank you very much.